Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. A warm welcome. I'm Jeremy Mags. Coming up on the program today, Johannesburg's budget battle is only just beginning. A private vaccine deal gives the foot and mouth disease a fresh firepower in its fight. The new space race is targeting water, weather, and lives, and why well-known brands are a magnet for counterfeiters. It's Monday, the 13th of July. Now, you'll know that Johannesburg's mayor is insisting fairly emphatically that the city's finances are under control, but I think the numbers suggest a far more precarious picture. The city reportedly has just 12 days of cash available. It owes billions to bulk suppliers and contractors and is also delaying critical water and electricity projects. One senses all of this is coming to a head and fairly quickly. So is the new budget a credible recovery plan, the one that we've heard of, or simply postponing the crisis? Welcome back to the program, Julia Fish, the executive director of Johannesburg CAN, an entity billing itself as a community network. Julia, welcome. Johannesburg is now officially in a financial crisis, whatever the mayor may say. What's the clearest single piece of evidence that supports that conclusion?
The clearest single piece of evidence that supports that conclusion is the fact that they simply can't pay their bills. And we're seeing this throughout all the entities, that each one of them has a massive backlog in not only contractor accounts, but also bulk suppliers, you mentioned.
So the city has 12 days of cash available, if I've read this correctly. That is unusually dangerous for a municipality of this size. Julia, what does it mean?
What that means is they only have enough to cover the absolute basics. So when revenue comes in from the community paying for water or electricity or their rates and taxes, they have to pay salaries first, according to labor law. So that's 30% gone. Then they're having to dish that out to the different entities who they are heavily cross-subsidizing, and they're unable to actually pay all of their bills. So as we say, they're actually doing Russian roulette as to whose bill gets picked out of the pot and paid on a month-to-month basis.
So how are they playing that Russian roulette? What goes into the decision as to who gets paid when and where?
Our understanding is that it's actually quite serious, that there's depot managers or people within middle management who these contractors out of desperation are approaching and slipping a couple of brown envelopes their way to try and get their invoice pushed to the top. And because of that, there's no understanding of exactly who's going to get paid, why they're going to get paid, or which ones get paid on a basis, which means that only 35% of the city's invoices get paid within a 30-day period, which is financial norms.
So this is not sustainable, obviously. How close to complete collapse are we, and what would that look like if it were to happen?
Some would argue that we're already in complete collapse. So if you look at the timeline of what's happened, in June of this month, we already saw frontline services such as JMPD fleets grounded because of a disagreement with AfriRent, which is the fleet services team. They also have the fleet for pick it up, and we're seeing massive non-collection of refuse across the city because that fleet has been grounded. The JRA's fleet didn't have enough money to pay for their fuel, so they're not able to go out and fill potholes. That money suddenly appeared and their cards were unfrozen. But then we had the sheriff showing up at Tuso House, which is where the entire finance system sits. That's where the employees of the accounting structure operate from. And their furniture and assets were attached. That's been returned. They found the money to deal with that lease agreement issue. But now we're also seeing that Eskom has issued a notice to potentially shut down the power supply to the city of Joburg because we haven't paid our bill. And when Treasury retracted the equitable share grant, that was the only cash in hand because it's a non-conditional grant. Technically, the city can do this. That was the only cash that they had in hand to actually pay Rand Water and Eskom. So we're at a moment when we're about to have another round of water disruptions due to maintenance, but many suburbs across the city are already seeing lower flows. And it's suspected that because we were unable to pay our bulk supply, they're actually throttling the city of Joburg right now.
So,
So there's clear evidence that there are massive problems already.
and as a result of that, if this is financial Russian roulette, as you call it, is there an essential service that is most at risk right now as we have this conversation within the next couple of days, perhaps?
We're already in that position. So where I sit in Johannesburg this morning talking to you, I don't have power. City power is at absolute breaking point. They have a massive overdraft. We're talking 22 million rand. And from that, there's interest payments, there's a whole bunch of other things. So this in the middle of winter, in what is a very sensitive time for people, there could be no power. And Eskom is threatening to shut off the whole city unless we make serious payments. And also, as residents start making comments as to how this will affect us, the power could go off on the 28th of July.
And Julia, the approval of these turnaround plans for Johannesburg Water and City Power, they hold no currency at all, I would suspect you'd say.
The turnaround plans are actually required in terms of the Operation Vulindlela National Treasury project called the Municipal Services Trading Reforms, which is supposed to ring fence the money so that they can have a clear line of governance over their own structures. Technically, Joburg Water is supposed to be ring fenced from the 1st of July with the new budget, and get given the 7 billion rand a year that they actually bill. And that will go some way to fixing things. But these turnaround strategies, as they've written them, are not being funded. So they're very honest, they're very workable, and they will come up with great solutions. But those were passed 2 years ago in the case of those two entities. But when you look at the budget that they're being allocated year on year, it's not enough. So what they're getting is significantly short of the operations budget that they need at City Power, though they have been given a significantly higher CapEx budget this year, which is for, new projects and so and new substations and the like. But Joburg Water is only getting funded half of what it needs, according to the turnaround strategy, to make any real difference. And even though we've got these honest plans and things are going to be ring-fenced, there still is just not enough money to catch up on the massive backlog of a lack of maintenance and burgeoning contracts and staff costs.
So if that's the case, if revenue is insufficient, what gives first? Is it salaries, political programs, capital projects, outside contractors? Where do you start looking?
What's giving way first are the nice-to-haves, which is necessary. We can't necessarily expand the infrastructure to new areas like they're building in Southern Farms. So those kind of projects have to step back. But what's also falling by the wayside are the really necessary projects. There are several city power projects, including the upgrading of Eikenhof, which is the major water pumping system that feeds most of the west of the side of Johannesburg. And if that goes down, people don't have water. So the upgrading of that power infrastructure has been delayed. We're also seeing Hurst Hill, which is also part of that Eikenhof structure, that reservoir has been delayed. City Power have actually had to pull back the security they have for their infrastructure because they don't have money. So it's actually essential services that are losing the funding when it should be austerity at management level, where we're not paying the CEOs above what the city manager who's supposed to oversee them is. And also, extending how many senior managers we have. We're pushing more money into salaries where it really shouldn't go, and we're cutting it from essential services, and that's very worrying.
Julia Fish is the executive director of the organization Johannesburg Can. Thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's fight against foot and mouth disease has received a potentially significant boost, with government now agreeing to allow commercial farmers and the private sector to procure and distribute vaccines. Now, supporters say this could accelerate a vaccination program that's been hampered, as we've reported in the past, by a centralized state system. But vaccine access, I imagine, alone is not going to stop this outbreak unless the doses are delivered quickly, safely, and at sufficient scale. Welcome back to the program, Andrew Morphew, who speaks for the organization FMD Response SA. Andrew, welcome. So does this agreement finally then remove the biggest obstacle to bringing this disease under control?
Jeremy, hi. Thanks for having me on. This certainly is a massive change for us. And if we quickly have a look at what happened, there are three massive things that the minister has managed to achieve. First, he's allowed private parallel imports into the country. So we've got multiple streams of private vaccine now allowed to be imported. Then secondly, he's allowed direct distribution from the importer to vets. So it's now traveling on the shortest possible route from importers to vets, and farmers are allowed to buy it directly from the vet. And then he's allowed farmers to vaccinate. So he's now opened up a huge amount more hands to be able to do the vaccinations. And it'll speed things up a lot. It'll bring a lot more vaccine into the country and get it to farmers more directly. What it doesn't do, though, is organize that vaccine into strategic campaigns and create population immunity. And that is still something that needs to be worked on. So it is a massive win, but there is still work to do.
And that's a big problem, because the last thing you want is a system that creates uneven access, where maybe large farmers get vaccinated first, smaller producers get left behind. And the problem then could still exist and even exacerbate.
That's correct. So the last thing we want is uneven supply. And we've seen the consequences of uneven distribution of vaccine. If you leave animals behind, you leave a patchwork of immunity, the vaccine can exploit those, the virus can exploit those gaps. So what we want to see is uniform application of vaccine across areas to create a wall of immunity that the virus cannot penetrate. And to do that, we need the government to continue to do what it's been doing and push vaccine through state channels into communal animals and small-scale farmers, people that cannot afford to vaccinate themselves. And then we need the private channels to get a vaccine through to farmers that can afford and elect to vaccinate themselves. So we need that to work, but we still need the state to control how vaccination is done. We understand now we're still in an emergency context where we need to just as quickly as we can get vaccine into animals, but we need to try and coordinate this into a more organized response where we have campaigns in areas. Animals are vaccinated in 6 to 8 weeks, and that is then repeated every 6 months as the immunity of a vaccine wanes in 6 months.
And what are your concerns?
That is the work that has still got to be done.
And what are your concerns, Andrew, about how that process is going to be regulated?
Look, given what the minister's achieved in 2 weeks, I've no doubt that it's on his to-do list and that he will get to it. So we've every anticipation that we will see an improvement in this as well. It does take time, and there's a lot to coordinate. And as I say, we're still doing kind of arbitrage and just trying to get as much vaccine as we can out there. So we are hoping that it is on the minister's to-do list, and we'll certainly support him in driving it in that direction.
That vaccine is available, isn't it?
There is vaccine in the country. All the vaccine that is currently in the country is under state control. There's a 2 million dose batch, which is arriving in the next week or so, which we hope will be funneled into private supply. So at the moment, vaccine supply, as far as the private route goes, is still a constraint. But we're hoping that'll be removed as soon as this next batch arrives.
You say you hope it'll be funneled into private supply, but isn't that the whole raison d'etre of this exercise and new agreement anyway?
It is. So the vaccine at the moment has been ordered in by the state, and it It is distributed at the direction of the director of animal health. So what we need is for the director to give the instruction to the importer to allow that vaccine to be distributed privately.
So you talk about most cattle need to be vaccinated. I think you said to me within 6 to 8 weeks. Is it logistically achievable, do you think?
It is logistically achievable. And now what the minister's done in letting farmers vaccinate, you've got a huge number of farmers that are able to vaccinate their own cattle. And you won't find a farmer in the country that takes 2 months, more than 2 months, to vaccinate their herd. So by breaking it up into smaller parcels, manageable parcels, giving each farmer the responsibility for his herd, you make it a lot more achievable than it was a week ago.
And what happens, Andrew, if the booster doses are delayed or the vaccination coverage falls even slightly below the required level that you've just outlined to me?
So if booster doses are delayed, obviously we then, animals that were vaccinated and had an element of immunity will find that immunity waning. As it wanes, they become susceptible and they are then more likely to be infected. So we find the hard work that has been done then is wasted to a certain extent because we have let those gaps emerge. So it is critical that we keep those boosters coming and they put into animals on time. And if we don't blanket vaccinate, then we create that patchwork effect. So those two things need to work together. We need to tighten their campaigns. Get them done properly so that all animals are immune at the same time, and then we need to close in the gaps.
Are you still asking yourself why it took court action before government agreed to involve the private sector?
Jeremy, we're looking forwards at the moment, and we don't understand why the decisions that were taken in the past were taken. It makes no sense to us at all, but we're hugely grateful now that we're headed in a direction that we feel is positive, collaborative, and is assisting us in getting on top of this now.
Andrew Morphew, thank you very much indeed. He speaks for the organization FMD Response SA.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's space program, I see, is moving from the stars to the streets, with the South African National Space Agency launching satellite-powered tools to help track air pollution, flood risk, and water security. As I understand it, the promise is simple: better data, earlier warnings, and smarter decisions before disasters hit. But obviously, here's the question: can satellite intelligence really change what is actually happening on the ground? Well, let's put that to Dr. Cecilia Masimola, who is principal scientist at the SA National Space Agency. Cecilia, a warm welcome to you. So is this still space science, or has it now become an issue of basic service delivery, do you think?
I think it's actually both, because we can use space science to actually solve those issues, community issues.
So what can satellites see then that municipalities and departments are currently missing?
Thank you for that question. For example, with the one that we just launched last week, which is the water resources and air quality, as well as the flood. For example, air quality, actually we can monitor, or we can actually assess air quality, like particles, using those remote sensing data. And for water resources, actually we can monitor water quality as well as the dam level over time, which is important also for monitoring water and also as an to monitor the impact of drought. And then for flood, actually we can see areas that are prone to flood, or we can even see flood before it's happened. So it can help actually in municipality to plan better with all these tools that we just launched.
And in the simplest terms, can you explain to us what exactly you've launched? In other words, the tools and the technology behind it.
Okay, we've launched a flood monitoring tool, which is one of the tools that we use satellite data. So we convert satellite data. We know that satellite, they come in pixel format, which is just an array of numbers. But we convert that information into something that actually a decision maker can actually use for planning. For example, with that flood monitoring tool, we can actually see areas that are prone to floods. And also, we can also forecast floods in terms of areas that, example, during rainy, when it's raining, we can see areas that are actually going to experience flood. So with that kind of information, then municipality and also disaster managers, they can actually use that information for planning and also for evacuation if there's a need for that.
Again, if you can just explain to me, when you say a tool, are we talking about a low orbiting satellite or something that takes information and data from a satellite that already exists?
They're actually not a low orbiting satellite because they are some around 750 kilometers away from the ground. And this satellite, they actually pass around South Africa every 5 days. So we take that information and then we translate it in something that can be used, information that can be actually used for decision making. So there are satellites that orbits every 5 days, and we take that information and then we use it to generate those information.
And crucial to that, as I understand it, is acting on that information. You speak about making decisions. The danger here, the risk, is if the satellite data says danger is coming and local authorities do something or don't do anything at all, it's a waste of time.
Yes, because I mean, we have to educate them because sometimes by just giving authorities information without educating or capacitating them how to use that information, so it's just going to be a waste of time. So we generate information and then we capacitate them so that we know. We tell them or we capacitate them in how to use the data, actually to extract information from the data or to make decision using the data that we provide using those tools.
And are you confident that that capacitation is happening? Are municipalities technically ready, adept at this point to use this vital information correctly?
We are currently, as Sansa, because we just rolled out this information or this tool, so we are busy with that capacitating those personnel, municipalities, the district, and also government as a whole.
Are you starting to gather data already, and have you reached any kind of conclusion at this point, or is it too early?
I think it's too early right now, but we did gather information before actually embarking on developing these tools, because we involved them just to understand their needs. So these tools, actually, they know about the tools. It's just that the only capacity is just to make sure that they use them for their own benefits. So yes, we did involve them during when we were still thinking of developing all these tools. We went out for stakeholder engagement, scoping, so just to understand their needs.
And it's critical, Cecilia, that works, because this can't become another impressive dashboard of data that nobody acts on.
No, I don't think it's going to be one of those, because we are actually involving them. We are starting even the road shows to make sure that they understand the importance and also how they can actually use these tools.
And Cecilia, how available is this information? What will the public be able to see, and what would remain in the hands of the authorities?
What they will be able to see from these tools is actually information regarding, for example, in terms of air quality, information regarding air quality around their municipality or around their district, that on the dashboard. And also, it's not just about dashboard. It's also about, because we generate also reports in the format that actually they tell us how to actually generate those reports, and then we send it to them. So it's not... And what they're not going to is the IP behind the dashboards. So, but information, they'll get information.
And just a final question, is this a very expensive program?
I would say it's expensive, because some of the satellite imagery, they're quite expensive, especially if you are going at what level. They're quite expensive because it's finer, they're not freely available. And also the information that you get from those satellites, it's very fine or it's high resolution. So they can be quite expensive. But I mean, we work with our department. So those are things that actually we can as yeah, we can talk about, we can arrange. But in terms of monitoring and also getting those satellites, it's quite expensive to get satellites. But
Are you able
information.
to disclose the budget for a program like this?
No, I'm not able. Our business developer will be able to do that.
All right, Dr. Cecilia Masimola, thank you very much indeed. She is the principal scientist at the South African National Space Agency. Thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's favorite winter jacket has become a target for counterfeiters. K-way puffers are everywhere, but that popularity has also created a market for fake versions. Now, Cape Union Mart says the issue is not only about brand protection, it also affects product quality, consumer trust, and the local jobs that are linked to making the real thing in Cape Town. From the Cape Union Mart Group, Mike Elliott, a very warm welcome to you. You say that K-Way is proudly made in Cape Town. Before we get into the counterfeit issue, just how important is local manufacturing to your brand?
Jeremy, it's very important and has been for many years. K-Way committed to two large production facilities, or Cape Union Mart is a group to two large production facilities. We have a factory in Cape Town that employs around 400 people that produces specifically for K-Way, puffer jackets and soft shell jackets being the core product. And so the majority of our K-Way puffers and shell jackets are produced in our factory in Cape Town. So incredibly important for us, and we've committed some time back to this journey and remain committed, so we want to see that grow.
When did this issue first come to your company's attention, and how prevalent is the counterfeit product?
So it's been a problem for many years. I mean 15 years plus, really. We've got a counterfeit unit that we work with that we keep on retainer year after year working on the problem. Over the last 2 to 3 years, though, it's become even more prevalent with the introduction of online marketplaces, where we've now seen it spread from just being sold on informal markets, but also into a more formal environment through some of these online portals. And so that raised its head. And then also, at the same time, we've seen the prevalence of AI tools that are very quickly scraping our websites and creating false websites. So that's kind of all of a sudden the online space has created a much higher focus on the issue and kind of escalated the problem.
Mike, some consumers knowingly buy counterfeits because they are so much cheaper, and perhaps you can tell me how much cheaper they are. But it also tells us something, does it not, about the real pressure that South African consumers are under?
Absolutely. I mean, I think in many instances, customers are buying these almost knowingly, but they're just under so much pressure that a low price point allows them to get the product that's become so aspirational. And so they kind of put their head in the sand and just go for it. So I think it's one of the factors. We understand that. You know, unfortunately, we produce a product that is of incredibly good quality. Fortunately we do, but what that does mean is that it's not the absolute cheapest product in the market. That comes at some cost, and so commercial reality or financial restraint is a factor for sure.
But you're always going to be dealing with that pricing challenge. In other words, how do you protect a premium local brand such as yours in a market where many people, as we've discussed, are looking for a cheaper option?
Yeah. So all we can do is remain invested in building a quality product that lasts. We like to believe we built a product that has that level of quality that it'll last longer than the counterfeit, number one. Number two, we've also worked really hard at trying to build access into the brand at sharper price points. So, you know, as a case in point, you know, our entry price point on a puffer jacket had crept to 1,200 rand, and we introduced this last season a jacket at 999. It still retains the quality that we believe the brand carries, but it really is a response to try and allow customers an access point into the brand that is more affordable.
So leading on from that then, how much of this problem do you think is about criminal activity versus affordability?
Look, Jeremy, my view is if the criminals couldn't get away with what they were doing, then we wouldn't have the issue. But there's clearly a market for it, so the affordability issue opens up the door. And so it's a double-edged sword. One creates the market, the other one creates the opportunity. But unfortunately, it's the criminal element that facilitates it.
You say that counterfeiters can't copy the technology in the jackets, and we don't have time to go into what type of technology it is. But the question, Mike, is how easy is it for an ordinary shopper to spot the difference?
They need to know the brand to be able to shop it, because they'd be familiar with the elements, just because, you know, you'll always see the logo sizes are generally off. The quality of the logo is generally poor. The stitching quality isn't great. The handle of the garment isn't as good. The hardware, the zips and those are to a trained eye fairly obvious, but you need to know the product intimately. Those that don't will find it difficult. But the reality is K-Way is only available through our own Capuchin & Mart stores or our own website. So the easiest way to know is if it's not in either one of those two, it's a fake product.
Have you had any success in taking action against fake sellers or these networks? Or is this a problem, do you think, that you're always just going to have to live with?
So we've had some success, but I'd call it limited over the years. We work closely, as I say, with the counterfeit unit and in collaboration with other brands, because often these operators are producing not just ours, they're producing multiple brands. So some years back, we actually managed to shut down a fairly substantial manufacturer, and that was probably our biggest success, but that's one in 15 years. We've had a lot of success around the counterfeit websites. Those we've been able to introduce our own tools and solutions in terms of preempting and finding registration of sites so that we can take them down as they come up. So we've had some success, but you know, it feels like it's you're putting your finger in a dike. As soon as you close one hole, another opens up.
And just finally, is there anything that you would like to see government and industry doing differently to deal with the problem of counterfeit goods?
Yeah, look, we would always hope that SARS and the border authorities can do more in terms of plugging the inflow of counterfeit goods, because generally they are imported. They get a cheaper price point. In their defense, sometimes it can be difficult because they come in blank and then they might then just put logos and labels on locally, and that becomes even more difficult. But by and large, they come in as counterfeit goods. So we work very closely with them. We always believe they can and should be doing more too, because that would stem the root cause of the problem. Without product, they can't operate.
Mike Elliott from the Cape Union Mart Group, thank you very much indeed. And on that note, we are going to end today's program. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.